You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 a.m. and next we are going to listen to a talk by Winona LaDuke. This is, again, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
You know, I don't know how else to say it, but you got to engage in this discussion about what it means to relinquish the illusion of power.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Indigenous environmentalist, land rights activist, and former candidate for Vice President of the United States, Winona LaDuke, delivered the keynote address at the Mario Savio Free Speech Award in Berkeley, California, December 4, 1998. She was introduced by one of the heroines of the free speech movement of the 1960s, Bettina Apfecker.
She is a national treasure. She has won many awards, been revered and distinguished in many, many ways. She is of the Anishinaabe people, whom we know often as Ojibwa. She has been an environmental activist, one of those who have most courageously and for many years organized in honor of the earth. She founded the White Earth Land Recovery Project and the Indigenous Women's Network. She has master's degrees from Harvard, which has been extremely instrumental and helpful to her, I think, in her struggles for the reclamation of lands stolen from her people. I just finished reading her novel, which is called Last Standing Woman. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. I highly commend it to you. Writer Louise Erdrich said, "This book goes out into the world much as a prayer. Reading it, I am blessed by the writer's use of language and strengthened by her courageous vision." What I found in reading the book was the almost unbearable pain and suffering of the genocide committed against indigenous peoples, which is told in relentless and careful detail, and then feeling the resilience and struggles of new generations to reclaim land, reclaim culture, honor earth, and actually try to save all of us with a generosity of spirit and a hopefulness and courage that staggers the human imagination. Winona LaDuke has been central to that movement. I consider it a great honor to have the privilege to introduce her to you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a very kind and generous introduction. I always feel a little bit, it's a little big. But thank you. It was very kind. You know, I was honored when I was asked to come and give this lecture tonight because I was very much influenced by the courage of the people of this community and by many of you who are here. You know, so long ago when you stood up for people's rights, I was raised by very good parents who always said, do the right thing. One of the most telling things of my childhood was every night watching Walter Cronkite on the news and the body counts. Remember this? The body counts, you know, and I can never get that image out of my head. The body counts every night, you know, and I know that that influenced very much how I think and why I do what I do. So it is, you know, very much an honor to be here in that same spirit of those people who engaged in that struggle. You know, it's also a big honor to be asked to give this lecture, you know, in free speech. My brother Jason is in the back of the room, and he knows that my entire childhood was characterized by my struggle for free speech without being sent to my room. This is my night. I don't get sent to my room when I say whatever I want to say, right? No. So when asked to talk tonight, I thought about what is important in my community to express and to perhaps give you some idea of what the things are that we work on, what I do in my work. Maybe that will inspire some of you. Maybe that will make some of you who have been struggling for a long time feel good, you know, to know that some of us way far away work on these things. We think of these things that are similar and why we do them. You know, I find that my work is motivated by several factors. In the teachings of my community, the Anishinaabe community, and other indigenous communities, we are taught that we as women are the mothers of our nations. We are the mothers of our nations. And as such, all issues of our nations are women's issues. They are of concern to us as women. And so that forms very much my thinking. Everything is my business, you know? Everything is my business. Which at times makes my partner a little bit uncomfortable, but that's how I believe, you know. And also as a mother, you know, I have two children. They're not so small now. I have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. But as a mother, I find I cannot understand why I should be more concerned about how much sugar is in my son's breakfast cereal than I am how much PCBs is in my son's tissue. You know, that is the reality in this day and age. To be a mother, to be a parent, responsible parenting seems to involve actually having to be concerned about these issues like that, you know? And it seems that you have to weigh them in that significance. I'm also, my work is also formed by the recognition of that we are part of a much larger. You know, a lot of the old teachings of Indian people talk about the intricacy of the web. You know, how we are all part of one web, and that, you know, it is all the web of life. It's what, you know, what they used to say. And we know that. You know, we all know that now, although it took all your sciences a long time to figure that out. You know, but that is reality. You cannot change one thing without changing many other things, you know. But that is the same in political work, that ripple in the pond. So you could do something small here in your one community, but it gives someone an idea someplace else that maybe they could make a difference too. You know, they see that. That those people over there, well, they stood up. Those people over there, they did that thing. That's good. You know, it gives them courage in their heart. Gives them courage in their hearts to know what to do, you know, or to get an idea that they too could do that. That affects very much our work, but I also recognize that that ripple comes the other way. And someone someplace else makes a change, or something happens, or there is a bad law which is written, it affects us too. And so I always have to keep my eye on this bigger picture, I find, you know. So I work in my own community, and then, you know, I work nationally with a lot of these grassroots groups around these issues. You live in these Indian communities, or you live in these communities, and you find that you are engaged in this intergenerational relationship of predator and prey. You know, we are landed people, and that which we have is that what somebody else wants. That is the reality of our situation. And you wake up every day, and that relationship has not changed. It is the same relationship. And so every day you must consider what it is today that they would like, and how you are going to not give it to them. You know, that's pretty much our job. You know, so it's kind of simple. I'm always thankful that the Creator gave us rather simple. I don't have to struggle too much with a lot of big things, but every day I have to say, oh, I hope I can do it. You know, that's what you got to struggle with. But I'm thankful that, you know, you're given that kind of clarity. On my reservation, the organization I work with, called the White Earth Land Recovery Project, work on three major issues: land, culture, and environment. Work on land, the land issue, because if you do not control your land, you do not control your destiny. That is the reality. especially as indigenous people, we are land-based cultures. That means that our people tell those stories about when the giant fell asleep by the lake and slumbered there. And that is why that mountain is there today. Our people tell the stories of, why our houses are constructed traditionally in the formation of star constellations. Those are cultures that are based on this resonance between these things. And so you must have that land on which to live. It's not an abstract idea. It is not an intellectual thought. It is not something that can be replaced. So you have to always struggle to keep that which you have. My reservation is not unlike many other Indian communities in this country. Very little land is left in many of our reservations. My reservation today, 90% of the land is held by non-Indian interests. 90% of my reservation land held by non-Indian interests. Why is that? The relationship is between wealth and poverty. Our wealth has become our poverty. The greatness of our land, 47 lakes, forests, great pine forests, the beauty of our land coveted by others, a foundation of fortunes like the Weyerhaeuser fortune. Heard that name? Weyerhaeuser. Start on my reservation, Weyerhaeuser did. Move west. Done pretty well for themselves, huh? But their wealth is my poverty. So our community, vast majority of our people are landless. 3/4 of all tribal members do not live on the reservation. Refugees in our own land. Every social and economic problem you can have, we have it. The statistic, if you want to be at the bottom or the top, wherever you don't want to be is where we are. Whether it's unemployment, 65%, arrest rates 7 times that of non-Indians, whether it's diabetes rates, 40%, everything you don't want, we got in our community. Why is that? White people in my area, not to diss white people, but in our area, some non-Indian people, they say, well, you Indians, if you go get yourself a job, you'll feel better. I don't know. I know you're all out here. You're very intelligent people. Well, we hope. In my area, people do not care for Indian people so much, non-Indian people. You ask me to come talk to you out here, and I am fortunate that non-Indian people ask me to talk to them out there sometimes, but sometimes it makes their ears hurt. It'll make your ears hurt maybe a little bit too. But I was asked to talk to the Rotary Club. And this border town to my reservation, border town, that means town that was built on my reservation, amassing the wealth, whether it was the logs, whether it was whatever it was, I go talk to those people and they say, this room entirely full of men. And they said, I said a lot of things. They said, I knew an Indian once. I always like that phrase. I knew an Indian once. You want to say, I bet you did. I knew a white guy once too. Yeah, this is how prejudice is repeated though. You understand what I'm saying. They come up with these things. I knew an Indian once. He did not have a job, did not want to work. Well, there you go. I knew several white people like that as well. But they say these things, they say, if you Indians would go out, get yourself jobs, you'd feel a lot better. And I said to these guys, I says, the problem is you are telling us to go out and get our bootstraps, pull them up, get our boots on, and we'll feel better. I says, the problem is that you have our boots. That's the reality. That is what is structural poverty, when 90% of your land is held by someone else, So we struggle to get back our land where, people who went all the way through the courts. I am someone who tried the justice system, and I have come to terms with the fact that they call it the just us system for a set of reasons, I'm someone who went all the way through the courts to try to get my land back. The courts, originally ruled that our land was taken illegally because it was. You cannot thumbprint a deed when you are a 13-year-old. That's illegal under the law. Cannot tax forfeit Indian land. That is illegal under the law. Blind women, how our land was taken, illegal takings of our reservation. Courts originally say, well, that's illegal. So we go to court to get back our land. Then the court says, court says the statute of limitations has expired. Should have filed suit within 7 years of the original time of taking. Having not done so, you are out of luck, you know? So I tell you that story because I'm not a, because I call that legal realism. I'm not someone who believes that the system works like that. I tried. I went all the way through the court system, and you know, the courts basically slapped me in the face, along with all the other Indian people on White Earth Reservation. Said, you know, we feel bad. And so we look around and we say, well, you know, we do not have our land. The courts say, well, it's too bad you people don't have your land, but we aren't going to give it back to you. You know, that's kind of a summation of the court decision. So what do you do if you're me in that situation? Do you say, well, tough, you know, that's too bad, I feel bad, I'll feel bad for a few more generations, you know? Or do you say, well, let us try to do something, you know? We look around our community, we say, we are adults, you know? I could sit here and I could wait for the government to fix it. You know, I could wait for my tribal government to fix it. And you know what? I would still be waiting. That is the reality. I would still be waiting. And I am not a very patient person, you know, and nor do I feel like spending the rest of my life complaining about why they didn't do anything. In the case of my government on my reservation, the tribal council, they all went to jail. 1996, 23 separate convictions each for corruption, you know. So if I was waiting for them to fix it, I would be waiting a long time. Tribal government, tribal council system given to us by the federal government taught us everything we know, you know, my reservation. So we create this project, White Earth Land Recovery Project. Our goal, it may take us 50 years, may take us 100 years, is to seek return of public land holdings as a start. A third of my reservation is held by public agencies, federal, state, and county governments. Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge, you know, huge other areas carved out of my reservation. I think it is a reasonable request. Return of public land holdings within Indian reservations to Indian communities. Reasonable request. Does not involve displacement of a single non-Indian landholder. Involves transferring back of assets which were essentially stolen in the first place. You know, so that's what we seek. It's going to take a long time. Government is easy to take things, reluctant to return. You know, but we will work on it. You know, my community says, you know, first, you know, we have this land for 8,000 years. If it takes another 100 years to get it back, you know, it's okay. We know. It's just like that old, you all know that old Woody Guthrie song that one side says private property, that other side, it don't say nothing. That side was meant for you and me, you know? That's how we feel on my reservation, you know? I see that little private property sign, that's okay. Nice I got that sign. You know, but that's how we feel. So we seek return of that, and our other piece of work is acquisition based on a willing seller, willing buyer basis from non-Indian landholders. So we acquire parcels of land kind of piece by piece, 1,300 acres so far, mostly maple sugar bush areas, that's maple syruping areas, organic raspberry farms, a lot of cemeteries. Indian cemeteries we buy back because, you know, they drive their skidders over them. You know, they don't have any respect for our old people. So we buy it back, put a little fence up. That's all we do, my community. And so we do locally. We work on culture, environment to preserve our language, preserve our ecosystem. I, you know, what is the relationship of this to kind of the overall struggle, the struggle of the free speech movement, these other movements? We are all part of the same struggles. You know, the struggles to make a collective better for our communities, a better for all. Sometimes I wonder, I feel like this society is largely caught up with the struggle over the rights of the individual. It is sometimes easier to secure the rights of the individual rather than the rights of the collective. And that, I believe, has to be a larger struggle, because that is definitely our case. As an individual person in this society, I may have some rights, but as the collective right of indigenous people, that does not exist in the framework of the United States. It exists only on the terms which the United States would like to acknowledge it. I say that now because, you know, yesterday, I think it was yesterday, a big case went to the Supreme Court for Indian people. It was called the Mille Lacs case. My reservation, just the reservation south of us, is called the Mille Lacs Reservation. Very small reservation, their land all taken. You know, they have a little area. But they had a treaty that said they could hunt and fish anywhere in northern Minnesota, basically. That was upheld by the Federal District Court, Minnesota. And the state of Minnesota, of course, continued to battle it. And it's up in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court heard it yesterday. You know, and I pray that the Supreme Court will uphold that little community's right. You know, will uphold the law, the treaty. Supreme law of the land, the treaty. You know, these rights signed by your government. You know, signed by the American government, these rights between nations. Somehow I hope and pray that that will occur. I have to say I'm not so optimistic, you know. People say this and that about the Supreme Court, you know. I know that many decisions against Indian people, you know, the past 43 cases that went up, I think 41 of them were decided against Indian people on the court. You know, that is a very bad record. I was on a panel about a month ago up at Lewis and Clark, and this guy who worked for Slade Gordon. Is that guy, that really conservative guy up in Washington? This attorney was up there and he said, well, if this, it's true because the Supreme Court said it was true. You know, and I know you understand how offensive I found that statement, you know. But I look at that, you know, and I think it is the same battle, you know. And one of the questions that Indian people have asked is that in the whole history of the Supreme Court, there's never been a single Indian law clerk, even at the court. A bunch of Indian people got arrested about a month ago out there, just asking that one question. You know, what happened? You know, you guys hear all these cases about Indian people, but, you know, never have been Indian people, you know, all these Indian lawyers, no one has ever been allowed even in the folds of the courtroom, you know, in that way. So I worry about that when I think about that. It is reflective, though, of a conflict that exists in this society, you know, which is deep. It is deep. You know, although the state of California, as I understand it, decided that it liked it okay if Indians had casinos, you know, on some level. But that is not, and it's a huge issue in this country. You know, I'm not a gambler. What would I say? You know, I gamble with these little sticks. You ever seen this Indian stick game gambling? That's what I do. That's how I do, you know, and I feel like life's kind of a gamble. That's about how I gamble, you know. So I'm not a casino gambler, but, you know, our communities, we have these casinos, and federal government pretty much says to Indian people, you can have a dump or a casino, you know, and we'll support your rights to sovereignty. And that, you know, we think that's good. But you want to regulate your groundwater? You want to exercise jurisdiction? You know? You want to tell non-Indian people what to do within your borders of your reservation? No, no, you can't do that. But a dump or a casino? Yeah, you bet. You know? I mean, I hate to be trite about it. But you look at the tendency of policy, and I would say that that is kind of within the tendency of public policy, you know, which I find indicative of the illness, you know, of the illness in the society. But it is reflected in the relations to Indian people too. You know, I know that you are all people of, you know, good conscience and good thought, but I also know that a lot of Americans, they feel like they support Indian people, or they support Indian sovereignty so long as Indians are poor, you know? If Indians have a casino, we don't necessarily support Indian sovereignty anymore. Or if Indians are in your face and saying, we want this peace back, you know, we don't feel so comfortable about that. You know, that's the reality. You know, I'm looking at y'all now and you're all listening to me very graciously, but I know that when we asked for the northern half of the Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge back up there in northern Minnesota, some of those environmental groups really opposed it. You know, and I am well aware that there was a very heated battle in the Sierra Club over immigration. Similar battle over Indian issues in the Sierra Club. Sierra Club openly opposed the return of the Tamarack Refuge to our community. Why? You know, why do environmental groups, or why do some groups oppose return of things to Indian people? You know, they said, well, if Indian people have that land, then they'll have sovereignty over it, and we won't have a say. You know, and I said to those people in the Sierra Club, I says, you know, I didn't notice you saying anything the past 40 years when they were clear-cutting up there. You know, we have a concern when other people, when people of color, you know, when Indian people say that's land we want to take care of, they want to tell us how to take care of it. You know, it's not like we didn't know how. You know? I'm saying this, I know this hurts some of your ears, but this is the free speech speech, right? You get to say things that hurt people's ears sometimes, that's right? No. I'm obviously saying it because, you know, I talk to you all, and I'm hopeful that, you know, you guys will work with your folks on this stuff. You know, I don't know how else to say it, but you got to engage in this discussion about what it means to relinquish the illusion of power. You know, that's what it's about. You know, the idea that, you know, relinquish some of that. You know, we have power over that land, and we don't want those other people to have that. You know, get down to what that's about. You know, what fears that's about, what that's about in yourself. Kind of begin to, I mean, I have to say, the challenge for the progressive movement in this country, one of the challenges for the progressive movement in this country, one of the challenges for all of us is to deconstruct colonialism in our heads. You know? It is, you know, I'm hopeful about that process. Why? Because at a certain point, I think that everyone figures out who their allies are. You know? And if you can't drink the water, if you can't breathe the air, I mean, all these things, you know? This is not about people of color doing this. You know? This is about people of extreme privilege who made choices that affected all of us. Need to move from a society based on conquest to a society based on survival. Need to move, I believe, from a society causes so much extinction to a society that considers and actualizes a little better how to live within natural law. You know, after all, you and I are not so big. We are someplace between a mountain and an ant. We are not so big in the picture of all, but yet we have this gift of reason. Remember that it is possible to make change. All of you have influenced and resonated with each other to make change. It is individuals who make change possible. That is our teaching, people of the seventh fire.
Winona LaDuke is revered as an environmentalist and for her continued struggle in the reclamation of land stolen from her people. She is of the Anishinaabe people, also known as Ojibwa, and founder of both the White Earth Land Recovery Project and the Indigenous Women's Network. Winona LaDuke ran for the Green Party's vice president ticket along with Ralph Nader in the 1996 election. The following is from a keynote speech on the Indigenous vision for the millennium at the University of California, Berkeley for the Mario Savio Free Speech Award in December 1998.
We have some prophecies that talk about this time and inform a lot of our work. You know, there's a lot of people have these sayings, you know, and I talk briefly about them because there are two things that we work on in our community and in my work and our work, that royal we of work. Two prophecies that I think also are instructive in their way about this time we're in. First prophecy is a Lakota story. The Lakota people, a long time ago, a woman came to them and brought them their teachings, many of their teachings, and she was called the White Buffalo Calf Woman. White Buffalo Calf Woman. Brought them a lot of their teachings. The prophecy said that when the White Buffalo Calf returns,
You know, when the earth is shaking and in distress, when the earth mother is shaken, then the white buffalo calf woman, the white buffalo calf will return. And that will signify a time of great change. And some of you know that 3 or 4 years ago, a white buffalo calf was born in Wisconsin. Her name was Miracle. And that was of great significance to many people. You know, there's a lot of prayers, and a lot of indigenous people saw that as a marker because it had been prophesied that that would happen. There was a story in my own community. All communities have their stories, and Anishinaabe have a story about the people of the seventh fire. And we have a number of teachings of different times, and each time is called the time of a certain fire. And they call this the time of the people of the seventh fire. And they say that during this time, you know, our prophecies talked about the arrival of the light-skinned people, talked about great floods, talked about the hardships that we would have, and then talked about this time as the time when our people went and they would go find things that they had lost. Would go pick up things that were put aside. And then they would go and return to the way. That's what it's called, the way, the life way. It's not called going back. You know, some people say, well, Indian people, they want to go back. Go back in the past. No. No, it's the way. It was our instructions. You know, we want to continue on a set of instructions given to us. That's what our prophecies say, our teachings say. So I say that to you because those are two prophecies about this time. And there are some big teachings in that for our communities, and I believe for all of you. The white buffalo calf's arrival, you know, you are here in Berkeley. You know, half of you probably have PhDs and past PhDs. I don't know. Very, very smart. I have a master's degree. I have one. In rural development, that was fine with me. Rural development. Okay, but anyway. Just want to clarify my status in the room. I know a lot of you have PhDs. I have a master's degree. But I'm really practical, okay? Rural development, see? Rural development. That's what someone who lives on a reservation and does development work needs, rural development degree. In the advent of the cusp of the millennium, the time of the return of the white buffalo calf woman, or the white buffalo calf, you know, you don't need me to tell you the ecological indicators of this time. You know? Loss of more species in the past 150 years and since the Ice Age. Global warming, you know. Immense rise of toxins. I mean, I can't even conceptualize the fact that before you bring a child into the world, across the placenta, your child is impacted by 500 chemicals. You know, that's what that Theo Coburn says. You all know what I'm talking about, you know. I find this to be really alarming. You know, these kinds of statistics, and it goes on and on and on, and we all hear them. You know, a lot of us are in denial about them. You know, that's the nature of America. We don't want to think about it. It gives us a headache, you know. That's true. That's how we are, you know. So Americans are. But it is, you know, these are really the problems of a paradigm and a practice. You know, my suggestion to you is that it's systemically flawed. The paradigm is flawed and the system is flawed. That's what I suggest. What do I mean? You know, simply stated, it's two different worldviews. I believe that this is a struggle today between industrial and indigenous, or industrial and land-based. I believe that that is this conflict we have in the world today. It is not a conflict between, you know, the left and the right,
Republicans and the Democrats, God, believe that's not, no one believes that, it's true. You know, the communists and the capitalists, it's not. It's between people who live on the land and resonate from the land and industrialism, industrial society, the predator and the prey. That is the relationship that has been carved out, hammered out over 500 years and accelerated with the more petroleum and fuel we inject into it. The faster it goes, you know? We're totally a society of junkies, electrical junkies. What do they say? A fifth of the income in this country directly for energy, you know? Shoot it into your veins, get going faster. Largest energy market in the world, huh? Right here, and it just accelerates faster and faster and faster. It's artificially hyped, you know? We say that the difference between the two worldviews is indicated by perhaps what a lot of indigenous people say. They say that there's two different views. That our society believes in natural law. Natural law is the highest law. Higher than the laws made by nations, states, or municipalities. One would do well to live in accordance with natural law. That's what we believe, you know? So we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do it, how to just kind of live within natural law. Some of these really smart guys like Wes Jackson, his theory is the milling about theory. What he said, figured out is that the more you do, the more land you till, the more progress you make, the more things you build, the more ecologically destructive you are. His theory is, he's this white guy farmer, his theory is, ideally, what the modern man should do is try to pretty much just mill about. You know, you see what I'm saying? You know, it's ecologically the least destructive. You know, just kind of mill about. Try to not undertake all those big things like that, because that's not, you know, if you want to get right down to it, you know, that's what he'd say. Well, okay, I don't know if that went over too well, quoting the white guy farmer, but I thought that was a good idea. Natural law, highest law, higher than the laws made by nations, states, or municipalities. You know, this country here, country of laws, got all kinds of what we call in our community the white man's laws. Oh, we got lots of them. All kinds of laws. Emissions controls, trading pollution, I always like those laws. Discharge levels, you know, what you can do. We got a law on everything, huh? You know, that is just great. What is the relationship between those laws and natural law, though, huh? You know, not necessarily much. You know, we can say all we want to. We are so anthropocentric. You know, this whole country. I mean, that's the whole society is focused on we, people. You know, whole thing. So we come up with one thing after another thing, justify the whole thing, you know. In the meantime, all I can figure out is, you know, when they even name mountains after small men in this society. You know, isn't that true? I was talking here about a month ago, and some guy says they name whole constellations after small men now. That's true. Stars, you can name a you can buy a star, huh? Register your name in a star, not, you know? How absurd. You know, what does that mean? We believe. You know, this society believes that it is so big. You know, instead of being characterized by the precept that natural law is preeminent, this society is characterized by the idea of man's dominion over nature. That's it. You know, the idea that man somehow has some superior right to all that is around him, and it is of value only in terms of its beneficial use to man. So he can make all the laws he wants, say all the things he wants, but that's the way, you know, that's the way the society is formulated. What's another distinction between the two societies? Cyclical thinking versus linear thinking. Really important conceptual difference. What is cyclical thinking? You know, most indigenous societies believe that, look around, find that natural law is cyclical. The moons, the tides, the seasons. Time itself in most indigenous societies is cyclical. Industrial society, linear. It's linear. What's that mean? Formulated by even the concept of a timeline. You know, aren't we all taught that, the idea of a timeline? The idea of progress, always want to go forward. Conceptually, in its framework, industrial society is about the process of, you take a natural resource, you input it, put a lot of labor capital and all that stuff into it, and what do you end up with over here? Huh?
waste. That is a linear system. See what I'm saying? That's the difference between a cyclical system tries to figure out how to get everything pretty much back to the earth and a linear system, which is what industrialism is. You know, formulated on this idea that all things are of value only to man. So what's that mean today? You build that up over 500 years and you got what we got now. You know, on the verge of ecological collapse. I suppose I should be happy that there's only about what? What do they say? Now that I've combusted my way out here to visit with you, there's only, about 40, 50 years of oil left, you know? What's it? Natural gas, someplace a little more, 230 years of coal left. What's that mean, you know? Well, first of all, what's those statistics mean? It means, first of all, that assumes we are going to mine and burn everything that is, right? I mean, that's insane. Known reserves, right? That means the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, take that. Every place that you could mine, every place off, you know, shore, that's what that assumption is on the statistics, right? Y'all follow me on this here? You know, that's what so maybe I should be happy that there's only that much left because there's only that much more combusting and that much more global warming we could make, right? You know, on some level. But that's what's wrong. It's conceptually flawed from the start. That's what I'm trying to say. You cannot, on some level, you got to reckon with that natural law, which is what we're coming to terms with now. You can make how many laws, you can make how many accords, how many agreements you want. You know, the U.S. can huff and puff and say, well, we'll do this, and, you know, that Japanese can say this and that. But in the end, you know, we're all on the same planet. And 20, 30 years from now, we'll have what? You know, temperatures. So, I mean, you know, I flew over here and there was no snow. I find that pretty alarming. We're a forest culture. Our whole creation story is based on a forest. We aren't a prairie culture. Creator did not put us on the prairie. Creator put us in the forest. And you know what they say? 200 years from now, that forest is going to be moved north. What does that mean to a people? This guy over here is trying to figure out what I'm talking about. I was looking at this map. Maple trees. Maple basswood forest is going to move 300 miles north because of global warming. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, that's what they're saying. So that transforms my culture. I mean, that transforms everything that is known, you know? So I'm very upset about this global warming thing. About a month ago, NASA funded this meeting of all these Indian elders down in Albuquerque, yeah, to talk about global warming. NASA decided to ask these Indian elders what they thought about global warming. You know what those elders said? You know, I was not at the meeting. I could not attend. I had to go home. Those elders said, from what I understand, they said, we knew this was going to happen. You guys made that mess. You fix it. You know? I mean, that's, you know, that was, I think that was kind of what was inevitably going to happen. So what is the solution, you know, to this? There's not an easy way out. The work that we do in my community, the work a lot of grassroots organizations do across the country is real simple work. It's work to try to change a bad policy. It's work to take on a big mining company, a big logging company, and tell them, no, you can't take that. You know? Sometimes it's work to make the alternative. You know, in the case of my reservation, we try to stop them from logging. You know, we try to do the right thing, get our land. And this year, because I cannot look in the eye of my sisters from the Southwest or my sisters from North Cheyenne Reservation or my sisters and brothers from the North, you know, where my own children's families from, who have big dam projects. Can't look in their face, can't look in the face of these Indian people from the Southwest or the West that have big coal mines on their reservation. You know, then, and I look at them big power grids. You know, we're all sucking that stuff up. Right here, you know, this power grid is consuming coal from Northern Cheyenne Reservation or you know, coal from Southwest or a big dam project up in BC hydro country. I cannot stand my complicity. You know, I am disgusted with my complicity in it. So my reservation, this next year we're putting up a wind generator. You know, that's a small thing. But in some way it begins to start some process where I begin to disengage, you know, from what's wrong. Instead of always saying what they're doing is wrong, I also say, well, this is how to do it right. You know, so I do that. Southwest, they're down there on the Hopi Reservation, they got 350 solar units up. You know, in some of those communities. Why? Because they understand perfectly well that they don't want to be, they don't want their sovereignty related to Arizona Public Service. You know, where their rights away, or if you don't pay your utility bill, that's what they say. And they also, what they say is that some of those people, they say that they don't want the power lines between them and the Creator. I understand that, what they're saying. You know, I think y'all understand that on some level too. That's a very courageous thing to say at the cusp of the, you know, millennium. So people make a difference in these small projects, in these small communities. What makes them stand up, you know, and say, you can't do that to me anymore? What politicizes them? Sometimes they see someone someplace else who does it, you know. Sometimes they are like a woman who is battered too many times. One of my girlfriends, I asked her how come she left her husband here a few years ago. She said, I was putting up, she calls them Indian coat hangers. That means a nail in the wall. That's an Indian coat hanger. Right? She says, I was putting up the Indian coat hangers on my wall, she says. And I put them up really, really high. She said, I was trying to figure out how come I was putting them up so high. And she said, I realized I was putting them up really high so that when he slammed my head against the wall, they would not hit the nail. You know? And I know a lot of you women know that story. And so these people who are, you know, politically not considered powerful, who are some of the poorest people in the country, who are people, however, with great spiritual, moral resilience, stand up. You know? And they are people who are related to you through that spirit of that you resist. They're related in that big spirit of those of us who resist. And they do that in their small and their big ways. They do that by going to Yellowstone National Park and saying, you cannot kill those buffalo. You know what I'm talking about? 2,500 buffalo killed by the Montana Department of Livestock over a three-year period. They do that like Rosalie Little Thunder, 55-year-old Lakota grandmother, walks out there one day and says, I'm going to protest you. Why? Because you have a right to take those lives. You know, because those lives are our culture. Those are our older brothers. And so she puts her body on the line. That's what she does. She puts her body on the line. She gets arrested. She organizes more people. You know, last year only 11 buffalo killed. Year before that, 1,100 buffalo killed. You know, some people put their body on the line. You understand that out here. Sometimes you just put your body on the line. Then sometimes you think like what Rosalie does and the rest of us does, when we talk about this buffalo calf, you know, white buffalo calf, we think about where them buffalo going to be 100 years from now, where they're going to be 50 years from now. We think about that 150 years ago there was 50 million buffalo on the Great Plains. Now there's 45 million cattle in the same place and no biodiversity. You know, immense loss of life, single largest loss of life of any biome in North America, Great Plains. Used to have 250 species of grass in an area of prairie. Today you go to a place that's grazed by cattle, got about four species on it. Go to a Nebraska wheat field, you got one species and it's usually owned by Monsanto. You know? And y'all know that's what's going on. So these people like Rosalie Little Thunder and all are saying, you know, we gotta stop that. They're saying you're running out of water out there in the Great Plains. Oglala Aquifer is going to be dry in 30 years. So what are you going to do then, smart guys? You know? What they're saying is you cannot make an agriculture policy out of a military policy, which is what they did. Killing buffalo is about killing Indians. And then you cannot grow life from so much death. You can't do it, which is what America did. And so those people are saying, maybe we need to return buffalo. They got this idea called the Buffalo Commons idea. Some people laugh. Oh, you guys are dreaming. Take a look out there. 133 counties with less than 2 people per square mile. Less people than in the old frontier age. That's what they say. Saying, not bad for buffalo, you know? They think about it, they work on it. They grow little buffaloes out there. They give themselves permission to think about something that's for the future. So in closing, what's this mean for, you know, y'all? It means give yourself permission to have a thought and take action. You know, take free speech and move it into action. Got a lot of great ideas out here. You know, I look at this report here. Last week I read this report from right here from UC Berkeley, Native American Alternative Energy Research Project, something like that, huh? All this alternative energy opportunities in Indian country, you know? Boy, wouldn't it be great if someone would come out and do some technical assistance and help leverage some money to do all those projects, you know? Think about this alternative agriculture, all these different things could do, you know? There's so much brains in this room and in this university. Don't waste them. You know, don't squander them. Apply them well. There's a lot of power in those thoughts. There's an immense amount of power in taking action. So I encourage you to do that. Remember that change happens. It is happening. It will always happen. It is really a question of who controls the change. You know? What I am deathly afraid of, and I know some of you are deathly afraid of as well, is waking up on January 1st, the year 2000, and seeing the year 2000 brought to you by Nike and Coca-Cola. You know? It is really not that far off. Not only in terms of time, but in terms of where we are at in corporatization. You know, 47 transnational corporations control more wealth than most countries. Oh, I guess it's 46 now that Mobil and Exxon are merging. You know, one day we're going to wake up, it's just going to be one big corporation, huh? I mean, it's not that far now. Although there's too many egos to be just one big corporation, they each got to have their own little areas. But they are who, you know, if you remain silent, or if you only talk and think about it, they are who will make policy. They are who will make what the future is, will control destiny. You know, it is putting those words and thoughts into heart, into action, making change, you know, that makes things happen. My one girlfriend from the Cordillera, I seen her in Beijing, China, at the UN conference, she said, they always talk about structural adjustment in our country. Structural adjust this, structural adjust that. Everybody in the South, you guys got to have one structural adjustment so you can get that IMF money. So you can get that World Bank money. She says, we don't need no structural adjustment. They need a structural adjustment. You know? The North needs a structural adjustment. Need to move from a society based on conquest to a society based on survival. Need to move, I believe, from a society causes so much extinction to a society that considers and actualizes a little better how to live within natural law. You know, after all, you and I are not so big. We are someplace between a mountain and an ant. You know? We are not so big in the big in the picture of all. But yet we have this gift of reason. Remember that it is possible to make change. All of you have influenced and resonated with each other to make change. It is individuals who make change possible. That is our teaching, people of the seventh fire. I say now is the time when the people will go and they will find them things. They will pick them up and they will go on their way. That is a teaching about the individual's ability to make change. That's what that teaching is about. That's why I shared that with you. So maybe that helps you in your work. I want to thank you for your time and for the honor of being with you tonight. Miigwech.
Winona LaDuke, Indigenous Vision for the New Millennium. Her speech was recorded and edited for Wings by Amy Pomerlow.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
For more information about Wings, email wings@wings.org. Wings is supported by our station subscribers and with gifts from donors, including the following: Suzette Cullen, the James R. Doherty Jr. Foundation, the Rachel and Ben Vaughn Foundation, Eleanor and Bert Alper, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. Our sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. And this is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
We are the Halusa Nation. Our DNA is of earth and sky.
Hey. Showing living by the G code. What the f is Fleek though? Don't ask them, what do he know? What I forgot is better than whatever they remember. Never mind, I'm off it, it's quiet form. Time to put the temper tantrums to the quiet corner. Hush! That's enough, said the ruler. No suckers allowed to break bread or asunder. The daylight, lightning and the thunder. Sun, moon, and stars and the hunger. Abundance in bundles. Blessings in troubles. Towers and tunnels. Views and valleys. Waves and peaks. Streaks you from sun. Planet Earth. And ain't scared of no Mars attack. What type of bars is that? Stay off my chat. I'm out there corny riot garments. Top five diet on them. On them super fly slicker top bro. Eagle diving on them. You why you lying homie? You won't play with my emotions smoky. Big chief heart rate. Big beak B-E-Y-I seen straight jacket come clean. Big said it was a dream. Now it's a living thing. With you and living kings. I mean it, I mean.
Confronted by the ally nation, alien nation, the subjects and the citizens see the material religions through trauma and numb. Nothing is related. All the things of the earth and in the sky have energy to be exploited. Even themselves, mining their spirits into souls sold. Into nothing is sacred, not even their self. The ally nation, alien nation.
The nation halusa, hallelujah. Taste of the future, the people, the shower, the pistol, the coward, the face in the suture.
lonely martyrs. Magic carpets, dirty blankets, Coca-Cola, soul controller, holy waters. Middle East mode, sand glorious. Cheat code in Babylonian, the Orient. My superhero got the people power. Yassin and Yassin, you should heed the hour.
With you and living kings, I mean it, I mean. Solid with it, true and living.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock on the dot on this genocide cover-up day morning. You just finished listening to Yassin Bey and A Tribe Called Red. That was the track. And the conversation was Indigenous Vision for the New Millennium. That was environmentalist, economist, and writer Wynonut LeDuc at the Landmark Address from 1998. At 10 a.m., so coming up right now, is going to be First Voices Radio. Oglala